In the last lecture, we talked about a fascinating pictorial relationship between Kemi Pizarro, who was 18 years older than his wonderful pupil, Paul Gauguin, and Gauguin, who created these enormously mysterious and moving and deep and complex paintings in the context of early Impressionism. We ended that lecture with this painting, The Landscape at Chaponville, by Pizarro, painted in 1880. And it's a painting that I analyzed in terms of its proportional structure and the rigor of its construction. It's a painting that actually signals another tendency in French painting that has to do with the creation of an abstract pictorial language that can be used to represent the real world in a new way. And it's this notion of an abstract pictorial language that's based to a certain extent on science and on what artists had begun to understand about how the eye sees and how we recompose in our minds from the visual stimulus of light the world of our sensations. And you feel when you look at this Pizarro that Pizarro is thinking about that too. You'll remember that we met the mistress of a scientist named Charles Crow when she was painted by Manet, and Charles Crow had made color photographs, had written a book about the mechanics of the brain, had introduced the Impressionists to ideas about the functioning of the human eye, and most of them knew quite a lot about light and color theory. They knew that the way that the world was perceived was through rods and cones in the eyes and through light sensations, that we didn't see form, we saw light. And as they begin to paint light and to conceive of the world as a light-filled series of sensations, they begin to structure their paintings so that their strokes of paint, and we see this when you come up close to the Pizarro in this region, that is covered with hundreds of little strokes of paint, each of which represents something in nature, but each of which also represents light, and nature decomposed as a series of light impressions. Now, one of the notions of the picture in Impressionism is that what you do is you paint the field of vision. And the field of vision is always interesting, and every part of it is pulsating and nervous and alive. And what artists came to think as they painted that field of vision is that they had to give it structure so that they could take that field of vision and take the impermanence out of it and fix it so that it would become art. And that sense of something fixed and determined and structured and thought through, rather than simply ephemeral, attached to the notion that painting is the real world of light translated by the artist into art, those two notions form the new notion of Impressionism in the 1880s. Now, when we look at this rather odd picture by Renoir, painted in 1887, which is called the Tyson Bathers because it was part of the Tyson Collection, which is now in the Philadelphia Museum, we see a work of art that is so composed, so smooth, so associated with the great art of Europe. We think of Boucher and Fragonard and Rubens and Titian when we look at this painting. We don't think of modern life and the modern world. We think of great painting. And this desire that the human figure carries meaning, that the human figure needs to be full scale, and that the human figure needs to communicate something at the core that goes back to the beginnings of art. When combined with that idea of a new compositional rigor and an idea of art based on science, on a new thinking about the way we see the world, those two ideas come together in the middle of the 1880s in the person of a young Parisian artist whose name was Georges Seurat. And you spelled Seurat, S-E-U-R-A-T. Georges Seurat was a completely academically trained artist, a Parisian to the core, who was a very faithful and deliberate member of the Academy, and who chose to represent modern life, the life of his own experience and the life of of Paris, of the Paris that he knew, the kind of life that the Impressionists had shown us in wonderful evanescent pictures throughout the 1870s in a new and highly structured manner. In 1884, he exhibited this picture, not at an Impressionist exhibition, because there was no Impressionist exhibition in 1884, but at another independent exhibition. And it's a painting which is now in the National Gallery in London, and it's called The Bathers of Agnières. Agnières is a middle-class suburb immediately west of Paris, along the Seine River, near the part of Paris and the Parisian suburbs that's was the most industrialized in the 19th century. And it was a modern, middle-class sort of manager and worker suburb, close to another town called Puteaux, which becomes very important for modern painting. And it was a place where people from the factories and from these suburbs came to the banks of the Seine to sun themselves and be amused when they were not working. And Seurat chose to paint these bathers at Agnières in a deliberate and new way. Now, this painting actually doesn't look like anything we've seen. It's not as smooth and as enameled as that glorious Tyson Bathers by Renoir that we just looked at. It, in fact, is composed of hundreds of little sort of long straw-like strokes of paint that are very carefully painted, overlapping each other to make this kind of image of a shimmering reality. But the figures, none of whom have any erotic content. And usually when we think of representations of bathers, of people without clothes and bathing, we think of beautiful women or beautiful men who one looks at their bodies in a kind of loving and an erotic manner. Well, forget that when you look at this. These are a series of working class men who are either unemployed or off work. We sort of think that maybe they're unemployed because the factories seem to be going at it in the background. They're in various states of robing and disrobing. They're various ages. Most of them are young. And they're arranged and posed in a manner which is absolutely deliberate and which has a good deal to do with Egyptian art. Seurat was fascinated at injecting into modernity the incredibly time-tested and enduring art of Egypt. And Egyptian art has not come up in our discussion so far, but anybody knows who knows anything about the Louvre, anything about France, is that Napoleon conquered Egypt in the early years of the 19th century, bringing to France, to the Musée Napoléon, which is now called the Louvre, one of the largest and greatest collections of Egyptian art in the world. And that collection was visited by Seurat, who did drawings of these hieratic, stiff figures with their perfect contours and their perfect muscles and their way of being recomposed geometrically so they're at once real and ideal. And he took not the poses in this case, but the idea of perfecting and enclosing and sort of forming, completely freezing, as it were, the ephemeral figures of modern times. He went himself to Agnières. He drew in his notebook figures, and then he improved them contour by contour, stroke by stroke, until they become so refined and so structured that they become great art, the art of the hieratic art of Egypt, of the most ancient of civilizations, is infused into the lower classes of France as they disport themselves on the Seine. Now, the one thing I haven't told you about this picture is that it's 9 by 12 feet. It's huge. The figures are full scale. It was made to be shown in the salon, to be an official work of art, to obey all the rules of art, which had been drummed into the head of the young Poussin, the young David, or the young Ingres when they learned their art. But rather than those rules being Greco-Roman rules, they're even older. They're Egyptian rules. And the idea of this extraordinary civilization being used as a mode of analysis, as a mode of freezing modern time, was something that was completely new to Seurat. Now, in 1884, when this picture was exhibited, Seurat began to work on another large picture which would answer it, and which was in fact shown as the great success in the Impressionist exhibition of 1886, the final Impressionist exhibition. It's a painting which is now in the Art Institute of Chicago, and it's called Sunday on the Grand Jatte, 1884. The date, 1884, is not the date of the picture, it's the title of the picture. And the picture was in fact begun in 1884 and completed in 1886 when it was exhibited. Now I want you to look at this picture at the Bader of Agnières one more time, and you'll see in it the river. You'll see a sort of green series of trees and a kind of a lawn or beach on the other side. You'll see a sailboat, and you see a skull with a series of rowers racing in it. And in the center of the river, you'll see a boat with the tricolor, the flag of the Third Republic, and a judge in it who is judging the results of a race of scullers that are coming to the end here, therefore being something that these people are looking at. They're not just bathing, they're looking at a race. And they're looking at a race which takes place in the Seine River, and they're looking to their to our right. And what Seurat begins to do in 1884 is to think of painting this side of the river, and the Grand Jatte is that. Here on the left, one sees the sailboat. Here one sees the skull. Back here in the background is the little judge's boat in the center of the picture. And here we are on the other side of the Seine with different kinds of people. This is the island of the Grand Jatte, which is an island in the Seine, which is accessible on the other side to the wealthiest suburb of Paris, the suburb of Neuilly, which is even today the sort of number one close suburb in France, and where people of a higher level than the people who lived in Agnières can come and disport themselves on the lawn and watch the same occurrences in the Seine as their poorer confreres on the other side of the river. If the Bathers at Agnières is about the lower classes, the proletariat, the working class, this is about the bourgeoisie and the haute bourgeoisie. And one can see that in this enormous picture, one feels very strongly the rigor of Egyptian art. This couple on the right are just like a pharaoh and his queen who are walking hieratically forever into space. The sense of the seated figures and their arms. This woman could be an Egyptian woman in the complete symmetry of her treatment and her pose. And one feels very, very strongly as if the aesthetic of Seurat has continued. But what's happened in between the two paintings is a good deal. Seurat learned a lot more about color theory, and he met a painter whose name was Camille Pissarro in October of 1885 as he was working on and had almost finished the Grand Jatte. Pissarro looked at the painting with him, found it extraordinary and powerful and moving, but he had two criticisms of it. One is that it was a little stiff, which obviously it is, and secondly, that it was a little dull, that if he's trying to do an effect of intense sunlight perceived from shade, which is the thing that you see when you look at this painting in the Art Institute of Chicago, it actually was a little dull. And what he did was he introduced Seurat to his color merchant, who had manufactured new, more brilliant yellows and oranges and greens, and convinced Seurat to repaint the entire picture using these colors. And Seurat did that with great excitement. over the course of the winter of 1885-86, and the picture appeared in 1886 at the Impressionist exhibition held in April of 1886, is this sort of blindingly brilliant and extraordinary painting. But if you think about it for a minute, if you're an artist and you've finished a painting and you have to inject new color into the painting, how do you do it? You do it with dots. If already in thinking about pictures, pictures are the representation of the way that the human eye perceives light. That's an idea that already exists. If paintings by lots of artists had been already composed of little touches of paint, comma strokes or little lines like in Cézanne's constructive stroke that we saw in the Cézanne-Pizarro lecture, or those wonderful little deaf strokes at the Paysage landscape at Chaponval, which you saw at the beginning of this lecture, then why not have them be dots? Because then one can inject color all over an already completed painting without transforming the painting except chromatically. So the dot, the famous dot of pointillism, which is what Seurat is oftentimes called, was developed as a result of practical things. And then it became theoretical after the Grand Jatte. Well, the Grand Jatte is so complex that one could give a series of three lectures of this duration about it alone. I was fortunate enough to have been for 8 years the curator of this painting, and I looked at it out of the frame and down and close by and through a microscope and every possible way that you can examine a painting. We've done pigment analysis of it, took x-rays of it, learned about the repaintings of it, all sorts of technical things which are fascinating but which are beyond the scope of this lecture. And I want to give you a little bit of a sense of its complexity. One has a kind of social complexity which is fascinating. The big couple here, the woman is carrying a pet monkey, not carrying, but holding on a leash a pet monkey, while a little lap dog with a tiny little pink bow runs in to sort of bark at this lab, kind of young lab by itself, sniffing the fan neglected by the woman who's seated here reading her novels, her yellow-faced novels, amongst a series of men who share only the shade. We know this man and this man could not possibly be associated. We remember that wonderful passage from Duranty about how you can tell a neat or a slovenly man by the way he's represented. Well, you know that this guy is probably a bank teller or a lawyer's assistant whose apartment is absolutely neat and who eats at the same time every day and who brushes his teeth at the same time every day, whereas this kind of beefy guy with big muscular arms who's been rowing in the boat is a completely different kind of man from this man. And in between them is this woman who is alone reading rather than with either of them. And this sense of shared shade and of the social and gender tensions or possibilities of shared shade with a stray dog sniffing by it makes the picture fascinating. What's also riveting is that there, if you read your Gentleman's Guide to Paris, and lots of male art historians of my generation have done that, you find out that in order to pick up women of a certain type in public places, which was a common thing to do in France, there are several ways that you can tell. One of them is to have is for the woman to have an exotic pet. So you can go up and ask about the monkey or ask about the mongoose or ask about the terrier and the conversation can begin. The other one is women alone fishing. And here is a woman alone or with another woman fishing in the water down here and you walk up saying, "Caught anything lately, honey?" in your vernacular French, and then you begin a conversation, and then things happen. And there's this sense, when you suddenly look at it, that there are all these women who, with the exception of this couple and this couple, are with other women or with men to whom they're not related. So this kind of dance of figures, which is almost like a chess game of men and women, is played out in the strictures of parallel spaces beautifully organized by Seurat. Now, what's riveting is that the men in this painting are like chess pieces. They're all different types. The soldiers here, the musician here. We won't talk about him, her, because it's kind of difficult to figure out who him, her is. The bank teller, the rower, the husband. And there are two husbands back here. And they each, their identities are encapsulated by what they wear, their uniforms. It's as if their costumes tell us their identities. They're only interesting to us as they interact with women. Now, what's interesting about the women is that the men, for the men, age is not so interesting. But if you realize that this is a young girl, this is a younger girl, this is a little girl, and then when you sort of get around to this strange hat with a sort of white back and this long thing is the hat of a nurse, and this is an old woman, a woman at the end of her life whose husband is dead and who's out at the park with a nurse. What you realize, and then when you look back here, you have a baby. This is a baby carriage, a little girl attached to her mother, a girl running, two girls who are sort of in late adolescence, one who seems still to be innocent and girlish, her hair down, her hat neglected, sniffy the flowers, the other one dressed to kill with her kind of armor helmet and her entourage as if she's ready to do battle with life. One has women, proper women with men, and women who have gone the wrong way, and women who might do either, and an old woman at the end of a cycle. This painting has the entire life of woman who can either fall or be the wife and mother who women are destined to be. And it is that drama, that gendered drama, in which men play subsidiary roles that he, Seurat, plays out in this extraordinary social painting of the grand bourgeoisie. Now, this painting, with its dots, with its stiffness, with its opticality, with its sense of science, completely transformed the discourse around Impressionism. Gauguin hated it. Degas was fascinated by it and included a bunch of works by himself in the room. Monet and Renoir refused to exhibit with this artist and left the movement in disgust in 1886. There was a sense in which you were either for or against the new scientific Impressionism, or Neo-Impressionism, as it was called by its makers. And the artist who was on the bandwagon was Pizarro. Pizarro brought Seurat into the fold as he had bought Gauguin into the fold, and as Degas had bought Caillebotte and Cassatt into the fold. In this sense of the increasing openness, the ever present openness of Impressionism is the thing that killed it. It's the thing that the tensions about what is a picture and how does a picture communicate were tensions that by this time were so great that the movement split. And this kind of painting came to be thought of as a painting that replaced the Impressionist experiment with an art that's more rigorous, that has a sense of its own structure, that has reverberations throughout the history of art that are in many ways very much like academic painting, but apply those lessons, both scientific and artistic, to the project of the description of real life. Zola or Flaubert could have written a script from this painting. And indeed, any of you who have seen the wonderful Stephen Sondheim musical called Sunday in the Park with George, you see this painting as an opportunity for a man to imagine lives from it. And of course, the main character, this woman in the musical, is called Dot, amusingly. But the painting comes alive and recombines itself in that musical in a way that Seurat surely would have loved. It did not stand alone in the Impressionist exhibition of 1886. In fact, it was flanked by two paintings that many critics and viewers read as part of this whole new project of the description of modern society, society as it was in 1886 when the exhibition was held. The painting to its left is this painting, which is called the Apple Harvest by Pizarro, and it's in the museum in Kirishiki in Japan. It's a large painting, almost as tall, actually, as the Grand Jatte, and was to the left. It represents rural labor, the labor of women who work for hire in the fields outside of Paris. It has this kind of realism and clarity, which is extraordinary. And it's a picture that Pizarro actually had worked on for more than 4 years when he chose to exhibit it. He started it at least by 1882, and it came to a conclusion in 1886. I told you the little story about the pigments that created the dots in the Grand Jatte, and this painting was also painted or repainted in 1885-86 with those same pigments. Well, what most people who look at those paintings today don't know is that those pigments were unstable. They were chemically unstable, and that within 2 years of the paintings having been exhibited, all of the colors went to brown and khaki and dull green that had been brilliant orange and brilliant yellow and brilliant green when the pictures were new. Both this, the Apple Harvest, and the Grand Jatte are now browned memories of once vibrant paintings that literally shocked Parisians with the virulence and brilliance of their colors. And we look at them now as almost through dirty varnish, yellowed, darkened varnish, as memories of themselves. But I want to stress not their changes, which, though tragic and irreversible, give the paintings a kind of, it's almost like patina, which cannot be altered, but the modernity, the sheer modernity and the boldness and the social boldness, the sort of repoliticizing of art that these paintings have, by showing you the third painting, which hung to the right of the Grand Jatte, and that is this one. It's a painting of milliners, and it's by a young artist whose name was Paul Signac, who was younger than Seurat, who was a follower in a certain sense of Seurat, and it was another artist brought into the fold of neo-impressionism by the oldest artist associated with the movement, Camille Pissarro. Now, if you can imagine these three paintings together, the Grand Jatte in the middle, the Rural Workers by Pizarro on the left, the Urban Workers by Seurat on the right, one has a project of work and leisure, work flanking leisure, and women's work, work outside the home, work for money, new work, the work of the proletariat, the female working class, and the social results of that project as exemplified in all of the intricacies, social and sexual, of the center painting of the Seurat. The modernity of this project was extraordinary and bold. Of all of the artists, Signac made his work the most rapidly, and it was the only painting that was all dots. One went from no dots to some dots to all dots, is when one from left to right in this extraordinary room. That room has never been recreated, and in some ways it never can be recreated because the paintings themselves have changed. Only the Signac retains the freshness and vitality and chromatic intensity that it had in 1886 because, for some miracle, Signac didn't use those pigments. It's actually perhaps best to end this talk about the final Impressionist exhibition and this extraordinary sort of triptych of large paintings by three artists with a painting also by Signac, painted in 1890, the year of Seurat's early death. Seurat's one of the great artists of the 1880s who lived only a little bit into 1890. The other great artist of the 1880s who lived only a little bit into the 1890s being Van Gogh, who we'll talk about in the next lecture. And this is this wonderful, swirling, fantastic painting in a private collection recently given to the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And it represents the modern man and the modern critic, Félix Fénéon, writer, art critic, soon to be dealer, in a realm of color and form that spins almost out of control in back of him. He is an urban flaneur, neat, extraordinary, even a little prim and pompous, but he's alive in a riot of color, which is no longer Paris, but it could have been made only in that great artistic capital.